And we are back, and I say we because I have a guest in the studio today. My guest is Lou Story. Lou has had a tremendously interesting career, I think, anyway. He started out in the visual arts, was trained there, had some success there, and went on to actually doing some writing and a little bit of psychotherapy in between. Lou, welcome. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you for having me here, PT. I appreciate it.
Well, there's much to talk about. I guess first, as a little introduction, you started out, like we all do, as a young person. And at that point, visual arts were more your thing than anything else. Is that true?
It's somewhat true. I started out interested in two things, really. One was social service, actually sort of doing something with the community. And the other was fine art. And I studied at Pratt Institute in Brooklyn. And while I was there, I was also working full-time as a counselor. And it was in a home for abused and abandoned children.
Aha.
So I was sort of doing both worlds. I was doing art, but also doing work in the community. And I liked both very much. But I must say, at that young age, dealing with the sort of things I saw in social service, it was too much for me.
It can be, yeah. You're dealing with where society has failed an awful lot of the time.
Very much so. And it just, so eventually I had to make a decision which way to go, and I went more toward the visual arts, and I got a job at the Brooklyn Museum as an art handler. And that's basically somebody who puts the painting up on the wall, goes over and dusts the frames, you know, basically just takes care of the art, storage and such.
Right.
And it didn't require much other than that I was careful and that I understood art.
Well, that's a great start. Looking at your art now, you do multimedia. I don't know exactly how to... A lot of your art focuses on patterns. Mm-hmm. In the same way that, I don't know, Matisse or some, maybe Klimt. Is that where you started, or did you start in another direction?
In the era that I went to school, which was the 1970s.
Right.
It was very much anti anything that was even close to realism.
True.
It was like color fields and, Pollock was still an influence and sense of splatter painting, and I was really not that. So I was very narrative. I basically like telling stories. I like something that visually you can look at and you get something from. And so working in museums was great for me because largely they had the impressionists. They had the kind of paintings where I could spend some time and really kind of imagine. So my work more or less stayed in that vein, and it's grown and changed. I've always liked pattern as a narrative element. So within my patterns, there's usually some sort of hieroglyph, so to speak, and that hasn't changed. What's changed in the last 20 years probably is I've become more dimensional. So I now do cast shapes, and Those sort of came out of noticing that in all my drawings I used a lot of the same images. So I thought, why not make them as really solid images and play with them that way? So that really, and then I thought that would be temporary, but that's what I've been doing now for the last 20 years. So I enjoy it quite a bit.
Yeah, that was something that I noticed, and I not from the same angle, but when I look at some of your more current things, It's not that I see the idea of the painting or the objective of the painting. I see several ideas. I see maybe several objectives or several emotions, and that makes me think of storytelling more than anything else.
Yeah, and that's really what I've been about. I mean, when I mentioned I was an art handler, and eventually I became an exhibition designer, meaning I went from sort of tending the art to sort of creating narratives with different objects. But I didn't want to do fine art exhibitions. That wasn't that interesting to me. I wanted to do idea-based exhibitions. So I moved more from art museums into sort of idea museums, like the New York Historical Society. We would do exhibitions there. And eventually I began doing exhibitions at the New York Public Library, because they were looking to start a program, and they hired me and a small group of people to create this program. And
right. So basically, you look for several different takes on a subject rather than the paintings of, Peel or somebody.
Sure. Yeah, no, exactly. It's a theme will emerge from someone for some reason. From that theme, like, I did some shows. I also had a business, a freelance business, where I would go out to other museums, and they would want to tell a story. For instance, at the Museum of Medical History, they wanted to talk about emotions and disease.
Mm-hmm.
So I would work with a curator who would do the research as far as really they would have the academic background. And then they'd work with me. I would come up with solutions visually to how do you tell a story in three dimensions. In other words,
right.
How do you walk through a space, look at different objects that will communicate what needs to be communicated.
And presumably be communicated well enough to draw a considerable number of the public.
Yeah, you know, and that's a good point that it took me a while to figure out how to be good at what I was doing, because very often the curator would want to educate. Like, they're used to writing a book, and you really can't put a book on the wall in an exhibition and not put people to sleep.
Right.
Yeah. So my job was then to sort of take the ideas and distill them. And I realized that I wasn't there so much to educate, but to basically inspire. The people should leave that exhibition inspired by the subject.
That's interesting. Do you find yourself using some of those same thought patterns in your own art and in your writing?
I do. You know, it's. I think that the art really led right into the writing in a way, and you know, more and more artists are asked to communicate the meaning of what they've created. In doing that, I got more involved as well in the writing of how do you narrate what I'm creating.
Yeah. We went through a period where in art, in literature, in poetry, in a lot of the creative fields, artists were really freed of the necessity to communicate their ideas, their performance or their art or whatever they were doing was supposed to be simply their set of ideas. And art that isn't communicated, well, is it really art? Or is it a form of psychotherapy?
Well, you know, it's a good question that I think there's art, and there's also what we might almost call anti-art, that sort of challenges, you know, is this art? And, you know, while that's interesting enough, it never really captured me in particular. I like the like, for instance, the artists that are doing Dada art, which is meant to provoke.
I was thinking Warhol myself.
Sure. Well, and even Warhol, I think, leans more into a little more decorative. But And there is a form of art that really is there just to challenge.
Right.
And, you know, I think it's like most things in life. You sort of gravitate toward what's more, what fits your personality better. And my personality is very sort of communicative and friendly. It's like someone sort of said about my work, your work's a little bit nice. And I thought, I know you think that is an insult, but I'm flattered. So.
No, it's not. Sometimes people have expectations of art and artists that don't really match up with art as a profession, mm-hmm. or literature as a profession, or really anything as a profession. Mm-hmm. But that's all right. So in your art, you are a storyteller, mm-hmm. and you have said in some literature that I read that a lot of your art is informed by your experience with psychotherapy, with social support, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
How does that work exactly? Can you articulate it?
Well, I think, you know, as I said, I for 25 years I designed exhibitions and had a business, and it was great fun. And I retired at around age 50 and got instantly very bored and went back to school and got a graduate degree in social work and then a doctorate in psychology. And my interest really in moving from art to psychology, it was somewhat of a return to social service. But
that's kind of what I was thinking. Were you still involved in social services to some degree while you were doing your art?
You know, not directly.
It's really a reemergence of an old...
In a way, I began to realize when I had my own business, I realized I was spending a lot of time trying to understand people well enough to tell a good story,
right?
And also to deal with the people I had to deal with in all these new institutions and mm-hmm. their fears about, you know, who's this guy? Is he going to be able to do what we need?
Right, right.
So I began to get more involved in psychology just in the sense of how best to maneuver my way through situations like this, you know, as far as where I have to produce something and get someone to trust me. But also how to decipher, working with a curator, how to decipher complex ideas in such a way where I'm not being too reductive, but I'm also communicating something that the public leaves with. And, you know, after I would do an exhibition, I would spend 2 or 3 days just kind of quietly walking around observing people. And I really wanted to see, were they taking in as much as I could tell what I wanted them to? Were they rushing by certain sections? Were they staying at certain sections? Were they talking amongst themselves? And that was the most helpful way that I could really learn how to grow as someone who tells a story.
That's really valuable. There is no profession on earth that couldn't use a good dose of feedback, and mm-hmm. artists so often don't get that feedback. That's one of the great ways of doing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I know. I think feedback, especially for someone who wants to communicate,
right,
is really important because it's, you want to know, is the message getting across, and how is it getting across?
Absolutely. Even for the most talented artist or writer or whatever, there's still that communication bridge, and that's so valuable. It's necessary if mm-hmm. if you're going to be at all successful.
Yeah, and again, the idea of success, you know, is something that really I had to figure out in my own life as well. That, you know, early on, I had quite a bit of success as a visual artist, and I was doing these very large paper weavings, and there's a whole narrative around that actually is in that documentary, talking about how I had taken a teaching job in New Mexico and I couldn't afford paint, so I went and dug up pigment from the mesa, and there's all this sort of stuff that really was about my income difficulties. But I made these big paper weavings with, and nobody in New Mexico was interested. I moved to San Francisco, and they were like, I was a star.
Yeah, yeah.
But
very different.
After about, and I made lots of money, had lots of success, and after about 5 or 6 years, I wanted to do something different, and I had three galleries, and they were like, absolutely not. This is what you're known for. This is what you must do, and it changed me.
You've mentioned your documentary.
Mm-hmm.
Is that available on YouTube, or how would people see that?
It's Marsha Butler contacted me some years ago, like in the early 2000s. She was putting together a documentary called The Creative Imperative. And she interviewed me on the phone along with many other people in different fields, different creative fields. And I ended up being asked if I would come in and be part of this documentary. So it is available on YouTube if you type in The Creative Imperative.
Okay.
It should pop up. And it's a really interesting, it was an interesting experience for me to do, but it's an interesting documentary.
Well, okay. We have some interesting and informative things to tell people, and then we will be back with Lou, and maybe we'll get a little more into the writing after the break. And I am back, and with me is Lou Story. Lou, we've gone through some of your adventures in visual art. Well, I guess we ought to do that now. You are part of an upcoming group exhibition at the Learning Center. Is that true?
Yes, it's. The exhibition's called The Savannah Streets, and it's, as you said, it's at the Learning Center, which is part of Senior Citizens, Inc., and just for, if people aren't aware of it, it's at 3025 Bull Street on Jasper Street, and it really is an extraordinary place. The opening itself is on September 19th, and there'll be two openings, one at noon with reception and artist talk afterwards, and then another one at 6 p.m. again, reception and artist talk afterwards.
Okay, and for those of you who are not aware of it, that address on Bull Street is just a little bit below Victory Boulevard, so it's pretty centrally located for people. Well, go ahead.
Yeah, and I just want to mention too that this show is a group show. It has four artists total. I'm showing some work, which basically a little bit different for me. I did castings of different manhole covers, and I've done paintings over them. I'm not calling them manhole covers, though. I decided to call them the urban medallions.
Okay.
Sounds a little upscale. But also Kelly Thompson is going to be showing his collages, which are really pretty extraordinary. Kristen Medford is a photographer, and she'll be showing her photographs. And Ed Perch, who's a local architect, does beautiful architectural drawings of some of the more important houses there in the historic district. So I think it'll be a nice range of styles and ways of looking at Savannah streets. So and everything will be for sale, and the artists will be there at the opening and get to hear what they had to say. So I think it'll be a lot of fun. And again, the Learning Center is pretty extraordinary, so if people don't know about it, go online and find out about it.
Yes, you can find them just by searching on the Learning Center Savannah, because there are other learning centers in the country, but we like ours. We like ours. You have gone now, after many years of telling stories and visual art, and perhaps telling and listening stories and psychotherapy, you are now telling stories in stories. You have taken up prose. Can you tell me a little bit about what triggered that impulse?
Sure. I think it was a combination of things, but mostly I think it was during the time I was putting together exhibitions toward the end. In some of the smaller situations, I had to do an amount of participation in the writing, and I found that I really enjoyed it. Plus, I began more and more in my artwork to add words.
I've noticed that, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, the words began to be part of the narration, and so pretty soon I just sat down and started just doing direct stories.
Right. The words in your art, words in art tend to be sound bites, because if they're anything more, they start to interfere with the structure of the art.
Yeah.
And so you felt the impulse to say a little bit more about whatever you were trying to get at.
Yeah. And, you know, I really started, my first writing really was poetry. And I've always loved poetry. And I think it's one of the more difficult things to do, which is why I don't consider myself a poet.
I certainly think so.
Yeah, because you really have to capture something so clearly and quickly. It's sort of like chasing down a butterfly or something, you know.
It's not easy.
But I was very involved in, you know, reading that. I've always written poetry. And from the poetry, I started becoming more sort of prose. I found that proems, as I was told they were.
And, okay.
And I started to get interested in sending them out there, you know, so I began sending out to different journals or different, there was an interest. So, and, you know, it's always fun to see, just like with paintings, you want to sort of see them go out into the world. The same with writing. It was fun to see it get, put down in some form. And I initially was very resistant to things that were just online, because my brain really still thinks print.
A common failing of many of us of around this age. Yeah,
yeah. Absolutely.
You did have some success in print, though. You've been published in a bunch of periodicals. Were those fiction or poems or factual, or what were they?
A few of them were poetry. The majority were prose, sort of micro essays, and largely they are memoir-ish. And I say ish only because I don't always recognize them as that or define them as that, because if they're general enough. I've written a little bit pure fiction, meaning I'm really just making it entirely and doing research on location.
Right.
But I tend to like to write about experiences that I know personally.
Okay. Sure, that's great. So the prose that you had published in the periodicals was more nonfiction than fiction, is that right? Or lightly fictionalized nonfiction?
Well, I was really excited when I heard that there is this term called autobiographical fiction. It was sort of like, it was, you know, it like took the straitjacket off, so to speak, because it's very difficult to write, for me at least, a pure memoir and stick to the facts. Only because it's, like, I started out with the book that is being published. It started out as nonfiction. And I didn't feel I was really catching the spirit of what I remembered. I remembered it, and this end of the book that is about the years that I spent basically developing an exhibition program at the New York Public Library, And they were going through a rough time and needed to sort of bring people in, and this was one of the ways that they did that. So, you know, that so that book, which is The Big Bad Blockbusters, is going to be published at Legacy Book Press in December of 2026, but it is under the heading, I liberated myself from being nonfiction, and it's considered what they call autofiction.
And that puts you in substantially less risk of legal actions, too, should you say the wrong thing about the wrong person.
Yeah, that it's, and as I said, all the exhibitions are real ones that were done, and the events are real things that happened, and, you know, it really is, it's kind of wonderful what goes on behind the scenes of a place that looks very much under control, and in fact, usually there's chaos. So.
Yeah, sounds like a well-used plot for movies and television and just about everything else.
Well, I would say it's pretty universal.
Right.
And
Now you said you dip your toe into pure fiction.
Mm-hmm.
There are challenges in doing pure fiction that don't come up in autobiographical fiction. You have to create characters. You have to create situations. And that can be very difficult. Is that something that you've encountered?
I'm getting more comfortable with it. And what I find that I do when it's pure fiction, because I do have a piece that is basically a full-length novel that I'm still working on, but it is fiction. And it's, I would call it science fiction, but now they call it something speculative.
Speculative, yeah. Okay.
But interestingly, all the people that I write about, I'm basically stealing from people I know and remember.
I think everybody who writes pure fiction does that to some degree or another. I think there's such a rich body of personalities to draw from that you don't really need to use a whole lot of your information to come up with an interesting character.
I find that I carry into the story my affection or feelings for those people that I'm now creating fictionally, but I have a connection to the original person already.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Do you in your pure fiction now, and I'm talking from the viewpoint of somebody who's tried to do this myself, okay? What I have found is it helps me a whole lot if I really have an in-depth understanding of at least the main characters. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things I do before I start writing is I come up with character sketches. And I find that as I write, sometimes I stick with those character sketches and sometimes I don't. Mm-hmm. The characters seem to morph as the story goes on. Yeah. And I noticed that you had done a talk on character transformation, the psychology of character transformation.
Yes. Yeah.
So is that along the lines of your experience too, or were you dealing with something else?
You know, what I was doing with that, there's a group called Project Write Now, as in
Write,
as in, you know, and I had done some, actually, classes with them, and I proposed to them that I could show other writers different techniques around character development in psychology, right? That there are certain patterns, that the Enneagram, for instance, has 9 personality types, or Myers-Briggs.
Right.
In other words, there are these systems, and there are also these very clear platforms for behavior. Like if someone does this, they're apt to do that, which will lead to this, and, you know, and they're people spent, lifetimes coming up with these really clear models that are helpful in understanding characters, human beings. So I was sharing that with writers as far as this might help you doing just exactly as you do. Often people do start with their characters and they want to understand them and want to know how they're going to respond in certain situations and how they'll be different from each other, because if they all seem the same, that's not going to be very interesting.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So, and that's something I ran into too. At one point in one draft, all of my characters sounded just exactly like John Wayne, and that wasn't working at all.
Which, unless you intended.
No, it just turned out that way.
Sure, yeah. And these, that's exactly why these pre-existing models can be so helpful to people. And really, not so much even a shortcut, but a kind of a clear narrative of if your character has this trait, then you can more or less expect this, this, and this to happen.
Right, right. And this is something that people understand intuitively, so you're not going to create any clangs.
Yeah, exactly. So, I often see this when I watch television. I'll watch a story, and I can tell right away they're going to break certain characters at certain points to satisfy us, which I find very unsatisfying. Mm. Like, in other words, you know, the cold, distant father suddenly becomes warm and communicative. And
yeah.
The, you know, et cetera. And it doesn't really happen that way. And it's not that there isn't some degree of closure, but usually it's never tied up quite like that or as sappy as that. There usually is some degree of limitation that people have amongst themselves and a kind of forgiveness.
They do. I think, and this is just guessing on my part, I don't know this for a fact, but it seems to me that in television they have to be so observant of the time they have available that you run into these personality miracle shifts.
Right. Exactly.
And to some extent movies suffer from the same thing, but when you do fiction you don't necessarily need to do that. You have a whole book that you can spread the transformation over if there's going to be a transformation.
Yeah, that's exactly why I think reading a book versus watching a movie is going to give you an advantage, that within the book they can be so more nuanced. They can offer paradoxical situations that we can struggle with as the reader. And I think people keep reading because they get more from those stories.
I think there's more in them. The most vivid example I can think of is that I am, after even these many years, just hopelessly in love with Joseph Heller's Catch-22. It's a gorgeous novel. And they made a movie of it. Mike Nichols, I believe, was the director. The movie is gorgeous visually, but it contains about 10% of what's in the book. You simply can't do that in visual terms, what Heller did in his novel. And I think there are multiple examples of people trying to adapt books to movies and it not really working out.
I wouldn't want to have to be in that position. I do think that the writer has much greater liberty to really give a more expansive landscape of human emotion. And
quite true. You have a lot of latitude, and most importantly, you have the time. You don't have to cut off after a half an hour or 2 hours or whatever the visual thing is.
Yeah. And I think some of the simpler stories probably communicate better in movies for that reason.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Movies nowadays seem to have gone pretty deeply into comic books and graphic novels, and perhaps there's a good reason for that. We're not talking Mickey Mouse here. The characters are much more complex, and they have very human flaws and failings and fears and everything else. But at the end of the day, it's much more simplified than a novel, mm-hmm. and much more easily understood worldwide, mm-hmm. because that has become a big function yeah. of movies as well. Movies have to be... The movies can't just appeal to the domestic market. They have to appeal to a worldwide market, and you run into less cultural clashes that way.
Yeah. Two friends, Emily and Sylvia, who do sets for movies, and the stories I hear, it sounds pretty intense.
Yeah. Well, okay, this is terrific. You have this exhibition coming up.
Yes.
And do you have anything else on the horizon that you could talk about, either coming up as an exhibition or stuff you're working on or something like that?
Yeah, I'd be happy to talk more about the Learning Center.
Why don't we do that?
Because I do teach an occasional course there, as do many other people. And the courses there are pretty outstanding. Roger Smith is the director, and he has done an amazing job in the last 20 years of putting together, largely from local sources, but also some people from elsewhere, talks and classes and things that are pretty phenomenal. And I used to live up in New Jersey, and I was involved with Princeton University. They have a similar program, which I now send them the catalog from down here, and they just are so jealous. So, you know, I like making them jealous, and they have reason to be jealous. There really is extraordinary programming going on.
Let me second that. And while the Learning Center is attached to the Senior Living Center,
right.
That doesn't mean that you have to be over 70 or whatever it is
no.
to attend. You
no.
don't.
No.
And they do fascinating subjects, yeah. and they do quite a lot of different subjects. You've heard something about their art. They do quite a lot of current events talks. They do historical talks. They do poetry. They do literature. I'm quite impressed with them. It truly is a learning center for anybody who wants to learn mm-hmm. about a subject.
Yeah.
And again, you can find their catalog online mm-hmm. Just by typing in the Learning Center Savannah. So that's the Learning Center. Nothing else going on personally, or are you still chipping away at that novel that's coming out at the end of next year?
I'm done with that. At that point, you sort of send everything in, and I've done that, and I just have to wait for the edits to come back, and there's a lot back and forth.
That's going to take a yeah. bit of time.
Yeah, it takes apparently quite a bit of time. So in the interim, I am working on another novel with a project right now, which is the one I mentioned, and that I'll probably look to get that out and about once the other one is happening. So it's so right now is me just mostly having fun at the Learning Center and in my studio with painting whatever I want to paint.
Well, that sounds lovely. Lou, thank you for coming. It's been wonderful having you here.
Well, thank you so much, BT.
Good luck with your exhibition. I will probably toddle over there at some point,
good.
If not for the actual reception. Reception's again, and when?
Yes, it's going to be on the September 19th.
September 19th.
And it's, as I said, there's two openings, one at noon and also one again at 6. And that's... The noon is for people that are at the center, and the 6 is for people who might be at work and whatever, but, you know, you could come to both.
Okay. I will see if I can manage that.
All right, great.
Again, thank you for being here. It's been lovely having
you.
Well,
thank you so much.